Yeah, I've always been like an attention seeker. So like that was the names that I kind of got a lot. That's the ones that stuck with me anyway. It's like just, your friends being like, stop being an attention seeker, stop doing that. And I go to parties and I'd always just have to be the center of attention or do something wild so that people will pay attention to me. And then I noticed that once I started doing stand up, I stopped being as wild and like at parties because I had finally had my outlet. So I think it was more just like I just had something to get something out, and stand up was the best way to kind of get that out of me. And I still love it. I still, doing a good gig will just sort me out and sort out myself, and I'll just ride that high. I love that high.
Hey, kia ora team. Today's episode is brought to you by Mr. Vintage. Mr. Vintage is New Zealand's most iconic t-shirt brand. Doesn't matter if it's a local pop cultural phenomenon, a sporting event, or even a New Zealand personality, there's every chance that Mr. Vintage has made a t-shirt for them and some product for it. Kiwi owned since 2004, selling Kiwiana t-shirts and gifts online. There's even a range of king sizes for us bigger fellas. Today, Mr. Vintage and us want to give you an extra special. How about 20% off any men's t-shirt? All you need to do is go to mrvintage.co.nz. In the checkout, use the promo code FUNNY, FUNNY, and you will get 20% off any men's t-shirt. Head to mrvintage.co.nz, enter the promo code FUNNY at checkout for 20% off any men's t-shirt.
No, look, thank you for coming on board. I mean, looking around and doing it, looking at some of your stuff, I mean, maybe it's because you have quite a prolific online presence with videos from things like Taskmaster and your own stuff and stand-up. But looking around, there doesn't seem to be a lot of interviews. Like, I'm not saying you don't do interviews, but there doesn't seem to be a huge number of interviews. So that's another reason I'm just really excited to have you. It seems that there's not a huge amount of you out there thinking. There is obviously some stuff, but not a huge amount. So it's very exciting to have you come on and have a chat about you and all things comedy. How was the gig last night?
It was really good. I sold out. It was my biggest crowd that I've ever sold.
Oh, amazing.
And which is like tiny in the scheme of other things, but I sold 107 tickets, and that really was quite like nuts for me.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Because a lot of people come to Dunedin and they say Dunedin people sit on their hands and they wait till the last minute. And even within the series of podcasts, we've had people tell us that they don't like doing Dunedin because there's like four ticket sales on the morning of, and they have to sell 300 or something like that. But then people turn up. So did you have a lot of pre-sales, or did you find there was a lot of walk-ups? Do you know?
Yeah. So this is like what you've just described is my normal experience of Dunedin, but this time I had pre-sales, and my manager does this thing where he doesn't tell me how many tickets I've sold. So I've got a real weird relationship with ticket sales. I don't check my tickets at all, and I kind of just wait for the day. And I noticed he didn't tell me anything, which either freaks me, no, which actually calms me down a bit more, because I know that if we haven't sold many tickets, he'll tell me, hey, push this more. But he doesn't tell me if I'm doing really well, and he hadn't told me anything. And I'd just been pushing it normally. And then he was like, yeah, you've got like 70 pre-sales. And last time I was in Dunedin, I was selling maybe like between eight, like eight tickets was the norm. And 30 was like a good, like I was stoked with 30. Like that was like a full house for me. But now, I don't know. I'm just, yeah, really grateful.
Yeah. Well, David Karayas, it's fantastic to have you on board. Very excited to talk to you about comedy. Very excited to talk to you about you as well. So that's good. It's good. I kind of resonate a bit with what you're saying about the pressure. It's a very silly example, but I used to play a lot of cricket, right? I kind of achieved a fairly significant level within the school realms, not never after school. And I could never quite get that century, out in the 80s, out in the 90s, out in the 70s. And eventually I was with a team and they realized that maybe it was a head thing. And so when I went past 50, they did, because normally the team would stand on the sideline and give you a clap, and they didn't tell me I'd gone past 50, and that was the first day I got a century. So right. I wonder if there's a head thing there as well. So what you're saying, I kind of get it. If you don't have to worry about that thing, like if you don't feel like for me it would be, oh yep, job's done. I mean, I need to average 30 or 40. I've done 50, job's done. So you kind of relaxed. They didn't tell me, and it was, you know, on that day it was by my, I think, 137 not out or something like that. So yeah, so I know, I kind of understand what you're saying from a different perspective though.
Yeah, I really relate to that. I think it's like the less things I'm thinking about pre-show, like tickets, if I can just like not think about that, then I can focus on things that I can actually affect, like on the night. Like I'm talking like an hour before the show, like rather than going, all right, what have I sold, then I'm going, okay, I need to make sure that this bit works. Do you know how you're going to intro the show? Focus on that stuff instead, which I love.
It's interesting talking to Donna Brookbanks last week about like touring and going to you know, Melbourne, and realizing sitting here that, you know, some like the Ed Gambles of the world that are coming to New Zealand to do the international festival probably don't have to worry too much about things, and probably there's probably a fee to come and all these sorts of things, until you kind of get to that level, it's all on you. And so going to Melbourne, Donna was talking about going to Melbourne, and you know, everything's on her, and she's got to sell enough ticket sales. Is that sort of the same within in New Zealand for you? So whatever you've spent on coming to Dunedin, is out of your pocket, and you have to sell the tickets, and that's how you know whether you've, you know, got a net profit or a net loss for a gig in New Zealand?
I was really lucky. I managed to get management quite early, which is quite funny because I've got the same management as Donna.
Right.
So we both, like, I have a real luxury of just being able to put the producer stuff to the side and let them deal with it. Because I'm terrible at admin. I'm terrible at organizing my life. And I did my year of doing my own producing. I was so young. I was like 21, 22. And then, you know, so I already had an appreciation of what my manager / producer is doing, because I already know how hard it is. So I don't mind him taking, you know, he works really hard. He does all the stuff that I don't want to do. I'm happy to pay for that.
Yeah. No, totally. There's a adage in business that as soon as you can afford it, you start paying for your weaknesses. Right? So once you get in business, once you get to a point that you've got some income coming in, you start paying other people to do the shit you can't do. I'm dyslexic. I'm exactly the same with admin. And when I'm doing well in business, I'm doing better in business because I have someone do my admin for me. So yeah, I preaching to the choir, bro. You're absolutely preaching to the choir. Your journey looks interesting to get into stand-up comedy, though, doing a little bit of reading, is that you didn't seem to start in it. You kind of seemed to fall into it. Tell us about how you went from, you know, sort of performing in, it seems like, sketch and comedic groups to stepping onto stage as stand-up, and how that process happened for you.
I got to tell this quickly because it's too long. I started when I was like 18, 19. I did this theater course, and I was like just learning how to act. And then I realized, like, one of my friends, my old friends who was a magician, I used to go to the magic shop in Christchurch all the time when I was like 15, 16. And this is just when the Christchurch earthquakes hit. And my friend came up to me. He's really well connected with the street performers scene. And he was like, hey, all the streets are destroyed, which means that all the venues for street performers are gone. So I'm organizing an indoor comedy night. And we've got some, you know, and then he told me the names of the acts, and I knew them from like the going to the magic shop. And then he said to me, hey, do you want to do a spot and just do some comedy? Or do what you've been practicing at your theater course. And I was like, yeah, keen. And so I did it, and I think it really shaped my style, because instead of following stand-ups, because when I was there at the time, all of the good stand-ups from Christchurch had left, and there was no scene at all. And so instead of following comics, I was following fire breathers, sword swallowers, jugglers, mimes, clowns, and they just know how to really fill a space for 10 minutes in the craziest ways. And so my boot camp was learning how to follow that energy. So instead of writing jokes, I just tried to make like spectacle things, which I now just call like my weird shit. That's like the easiest way to kind of describe it. But that was my way of like learning how to keep up with everyone. And so I did that for like a year, and then I finally learned how to write jokes. And then when I got confident with that, that's when I moved up to Auckland to really give it a good shot. And then when I moved to Auckland, that's when I really, it changed, because I was no longer following the spectacles, but the spectacles that I did in my set stood out now, but I couldn't keep up with the gag rate of the comics in Auckland. So when I went to Auckland, that's where I really learned how to add punchlines to my set.
So the experience you had in Christchurch, like after the quake, What year was that that you actually got on stage and did your very first stand-up set?
Okay, so I think my very first set was in 2012, and I did maybe about three gigs in 2012 because I was only gigging like once a month type thing. And then 2013 is when I started going hard, and that was two times a month because that's going hard in Christchurch.
So you're kind of saying that 2013 was when you kicked off it, because the thing that's really interesting is 2016 you won the Billy T. Mm. Is that right, 2016?
Yeah.
So like 3 years into it, like 3 years into doing it, not 3 years into kind of your professional career, but 3 years into doing it, it'd be like someone, you know, I don't know, playing soccer all their life. Look, you'll forgive me. Most of my analogies are sports. I don't know why, but they just are. Someone playing soccer all their life, and at 19, they decide to take up rugby, and in 2020, at 22 years old, they win the New Zealand Rugby Player of the Year. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not just like you're doing it all through high school. You're actually doing stand-up. I mean, it's, and you start being a professional, and 3 years later, you win this award. It's like 3 years into your actual career, you win the Billy T. It's mad, but also it makes complete sense for you, because when I see you on stage, I got a friend, Paul, right? Paul's the original drummer for Supergroove. And you know when someone's like playing a guitar or whatever and you're like, oh, you that looks like it's made to go in your hands. Like you're one with your instrument. You know what I mean? He's the only drummer I know that when you watch him, he's one with his drums. Like it looks like they're attached to him. He's meant to be there. I get that sense about you on stage, right? It feels like that is where you're attached to the stage. You're a part of the stage. The stage is a part of you. And it looks so obvious that someone like you would get into the scene and get success really quickly. Now, the counter side to that is that people who often get success really quickly then have to work really fucking hard to keep it. So you got success really early in that first 3 years. That's really impressive. And then where from there? Because it's been, what, 7 years since then. How do you reach the pinnacle in the New Zealand, at least, kind of scene? And then keep going.
It's really crazy just how you describe that, because I feel like that is what I went through. I went through was like, I think I got noticed a lot quicker because I was doing the crazy shock stuff, and I managed to find like a likable way to do it. I think that was the thing I kind of brought, was I was doing this gross, really like push people away type stuff, but I was really trying to be likable at the same time and see how far I could get with it. And I think that just made people kind of notice because I was doing something different. But then I felt it. I could feel it, and it wasn't anyone really saying it to me, but I could just feel it internally. I was like, there's more to this than just what I'm doing right now, which is the crazy spectacle stuff. Because I'd spend, in a 10-minute set, I'd spend like 7 minutes just telling these, like just telling jokes. And my whole point was I was just trying to kill time so that I could get to the last 3 minutes, because I knew that the last 3 minutes was really, really good. But I had to like spend the first 7 getting them to like know me and trust me and trust me that I could tell a joke. But then after I won the Billy, I had people coming up to me going, how are you going to top that? Like, how are you going to top that show? Because I was really pushing my body, really like going hard. And in my head as well, I was like, yeah, how do I top the next thing that I want to do? And then I realized after I pushed myself as far as I could, and I realized I found my limit, that's when I took a step back and I went, crap, you need to like learn how to write jokes. And I did the hardest thing, and a lot of people didn't understand it at the time, but I dropped all of my spectacle stuff and I committed to writing stand-up for a year. And that was the hardest lesson to learn, because I learned really quickly, but then I brought it to the hardest festival in the world. I brought my straight stand-up show to Edinburgh, and it wasn't ready. And I think that was just a real like kick to my ego to just go, hey, you need to work. If you need to work really hard at joke writing, if you want it to be as good as your other strengths right now. And so that's what I've been doing for the last kind of like 7 years, is just going through this, like just contrasting. I'll spend a couple of years really going deep on writing, trying to find new ways to find it fun and to fall in love with it. And then when I get tired and exhausted from that, I go back to the spectacle stuff because I know I enjoy it and I know I can do it. And so that's like my treat. And then after I've done that, I go back to the writing.
Because some people would find a lane and stay in it, you know, and there's no criticism in that. I mean, some people are the best at what they do. Like, again, this business idea is sometimes you go narrow and you go deep. You know, you don't have to be broad. So it's really impressive that you went away from your narrow and deep expertise and went, I want more. I've heard a lot of international comedians talk about the way they fuck themselves on stage is they put their closer up first. So the last 3 minutes, they do as their first 3 minutes on stage when they're trying to get better, because they know that once they've got all of their good stuff out of the way, they need to work pretty hard before, because the crowd now needs a closer and they've used their closer. So the closer has to be better than what their closer was, which was their best bit. So it's a really impressive thing to see you guys do that, because it's, I mean, like, not to get all tree huggerish, but it makes you really vulnerable, and it makes you guys, you know, I like it. I like watching, it's not that I like watching comedians struggle. It's like I like watching comedians work and work to find the path. And so it's really impressive.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It's like, I think the idea of putting like your best joke at the top is, it's great, like quality control. You're like, okay, sweet. I got to make sure of the quality of every other bit kind of follows the first bit. And I comics do different versions of that. And I call them challenges. Like, I set myself up a challenge to be like, how can I kick myself over and try get over this hump? Because the moment you have a challenge in front of you, and I think this is what you're talking about with like what you like with watching stand up, if you see a comic like give themselves a challenge on stage, then you'll really see their intuition and instinct work, and they have to fill in the gaps, and it's so sick. One way I really like, one way I like to challenge myself was just pull out all the spectacle and just go, can I get away with just telling gags? And I think that fast forwarded me. I learned a lot more, a lot quicker than if I kept the spectacle and just had the jokes and always had the safety net there. So like, every time I'm trying to just find a new challenge to make myself better.
So if you were to get like another Billy T, like you're doing an hour show at the moment in Dunedin, you've just done an hour. Is that the show for this year? That's the hour that's going to the international, that's then going to tour, whatever. That's the show?
Yeah, it's called Topsy Turvy, and it's going to be at the Comedy Fest in Wellington, Auckland in May.
Is that, what would that be kind of joke versus, I'm almost calling, when I hear you describe what you, I'm thinking of clown work, almost clown work. That weird shit that you talk about. What is there a percentage, like not officially, but like, is it mostly jokes or is it 50-50? What is it at the moment?
This way I'm kind of structuring the show is I'm really focusing on nailing my intro and making sure that people are comfortable. So that's like a specific part that doesn't have to do with jokes or spectacle. It's like just purely how do I build goodwill at the start? And that's a new skill I'm working on. And then I reckon the first part of the show is going to be mainly just stand up and jokes. And then the last half is when I can start breaking and doing the weird stuff and doing the clown stuff. Cause I noticed that my stuff doesn't hit as hard. The weird stuff doesn't hit as hard unless they have context to it. So I have to show them jokes and show them what weird calm level is like. So then they can appreciate me when I go 100% rather than what I've done before, which is just go 100%. People either like it or they're just so turned off by it because they've just got they're like, who is this freak? He's not even acknowledging us. He's just going hard. And it's like, I think after doing this for so long, that's a challenge that I like to fight. I want the people who don't understand me to love me by the end of my set.
Sounds like what you're talking about is you want depth to your comedy. I mean, because the going hard and going almost fuck the audience. I think about Andy Kaufman, you know, this guy who just he didn't care. You know, he got annoyed with them calling out Lockter, was that the guy's name off Taxi? Anyway, his character off. And so he'd read The Great Gatsby for 3 hours. And that was it. That was all he did on stage. And clear a room. And that's what he did. And I'm not saying that's what you're actively trying to do. But the idea of getting on stage and giving yourself a problem, I don't know if you've heard it, but if you haven't, everyone should check it out. On Spotify, Tig Notaro does this stand-up routine where she gets on stage, introduced Tig Notaro, yay, everyone claps, and she gets, thank you, I have cancer, thank you, I have cancer, yes, I have cancer.
Good evening, hello. I have cancer, how are you? Hi, how are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer, how are you?
And it actually was the week she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And you can hear her on stage working through this diagnosis that she got days earlier, and it is amazing. Like, it is an amazing set, and it wraps perfectly, and the closer is brilliant, and yeah, talking about fucking yourself on stage, because the whole crowd's like, oh, she's got cancer, and then they kind of realize that she's telling them the truth.
Somebody over here just keeps going, oh, I think she might really have cancer. Who's taking this really bad? Oh, it's okay. It's okay. It's gonna be okay. It might not be okay, but I'm just saying.
And then it turns into kind of a funny, heartfelt, entertaining story that gets to a really ridiculously silly joke at the end. And you can hear she's working it on stage. But if you haven't heard it, people, look it up on Spotify. Everyone should listen to it. Just look up Tig Notaro breast cancer, and you'll find the routine. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I really like that. You know, when you can hear a comic thinking on stage or going through it, it almost adds to like the rhythm of the joke, because you can see them actually working it out. And I feel like it's almost like textures, because if you're just telling jokes and you're just like going line by line or reciting it, you lose the audience, because they can tell you're not dead behind the eyes, but they can tell you're focusing on the technical stuff more than the actual story, the storytelling or the performance of it. And so it's like you hear stories of comics like living through something and just trying to work it out. And it's like, imagine watching that performance, you'd be able to see just so much light behind Tig's eyes, because you're just like, thinking about this right now. Your head's on. You're not just reciting it.
Yeah, and I think Louis C.K. was in the audience for that one, because I think you can hear him shouting out things to her, because at the end she's like, she doesn't know how to rap, and someone from the audience, and I don't know if it's him or not, but it sounds like his voice, yells out for her to do the joke she's been talking about telling the whole time, and it raps, and it's just a lovely set. Everyone should definitely check that out. I'm interested to know from you who you are at your core. Michelle Acor gave us the best way to think about this, is to, what do you write down when you're entering a country as your occupation? Donna last week said, what do I write on my census? So like at your core, are you a performer? Are you an actor? Are you a stand-up comedian? Like, what is the thing that you are that if you could do nothing else forget money, right? But if money wasn't the problem and you could do nothing else for the rest of your life, you would do?
I'll stand up. I'm a stand-up comic.
I sense that on you. I sense with you, your core is, I mean, I was going to say it, but you're at your core, you're a stand-up. That's how it feels.
Yeah, because I think with stand-up, for me, the reason I keep going back to it is because it's the most freedom you can have on stage. The only thing we have to do is just try and make people laugh. And it's so much freedom to just be able to go, okay, cool, there's no limit. All I have to do is fill this stage and make sure they're entertained. And when I look at stand-up, it's not just words and speaking. I want to color it all in. I want to like look at the presentation, what's behind me, what noises are they listening to. I want to create a whole piece from that. So even if that doesn't look like stand-up by the end of it, because I've added so many different things, at the core it's still coming from a stand-up place. And it's that mixed with wanting to be an artist as well. And I think like taking it seriously as an art form, I think that's something that I really love about stand-up, because we've always been like, I don't know, like stand-ups have always been real humble about comedy,
a mystique around it.
Yeah, there's a mystique and there's like a mystery behind it where like you just have to figure it out on stage. You just have to listen, put your hours in, man. Like, you can't learn this stuff. You're born with it. You're just, it's like, it's all bullshit. It's just because no one's done any of the study and no one can actually cite their sources or where they learned it from, because all comics, how we learn it is instinctual. And so you ask them, how did you do that? And they're going to go, I don't know. I just have like, maybe the whole time they've just been subconsciously looking at other comics and just picking up their rhythms and stuff, because, you know, none of this just came off the top of our head. You have to watch other people to get their references. And so that's how I'm looking at stand-up. So I'm really focusing on how did the people before me do it, learn how to do that, and then break it until it's mine, until I can look at it as my own version of it.
If you're a stand-up at your core, what are you at your pinnacle then? So, you know, you might talk to an actor and they'd say, oh, you know, winning an Oscar or working with Woody Harrelson or you know, there'd be something that would be them at their pinnacle. For you, no boundaries, green light thinking, wave the magic wand, as a stand-up, what are you at your pinnacle or where are you or how are you at your pinnacle?
Me and my pinnacle would be in about 40 years, being able to look at my work and then seeing that I've created, I've been able to capture where I was and represent that in a show and just have like a breadth of work of just different kinds of shows. I think that's what I'd be really proud of, because then I could look at that and go, look what you did and figured out here. Look what you figured out here. Look what you've, because I don't know. I really love the, I'm really curious about comedy, and it's not really about like, I recently, more wanky shit. About 2 years ago, I stopped focusing on external goals and making them internal. And that took a lot of pressure off me to be like, I've got to prove myself. And now I'm just making the comedy I want to make because I love it or because I'm curious about it. And I think that's the pinnacle, is just looking back and be like, look how curious you were on this whole thing and look what you figured out.
Did you want like a
physical thing? Because just for laughs in Canada, if I got asked to do that, that would be sick.
Yeah. No, like it's interesting because it probably also goes to show where your focus is. Like, and it sounds like your focus is really within the art form rather than within the accolade form. You know, that's what you want to do.
Again, cocky fuck. I've gotten the accolades. I've gotten like, I'm happy. Like I'm full of validation and I love validation, but I'm like, I'm all good. I can take that arrest, and I've had enough people that I respect go, yeah, you're good at this.
Yeah.
And so now I just need to find out like why I love it, but I still love the validation. I still ask my very funny friends to validate me.
So you've said a lot of people you respect give you props. Who's one that hasn't? Like, think internationally, think biggest in the world. Who's the person that if they came up behind you, maybe they were in New Zealand doing that, and they came up behind you and they tapped you on the shoulder and they went, you're a funny fuck. Who would that person be for you?
The one that just popped in, because it would change. It would change day, Pat.
Yeah.
But I think if Johnny Vegas got to see what I do, and he told me he enjoyed it, I would be like, wow, you have no idea how much I respect you and what you do. Because I align with Johnny Vegas quite a bit. I saw him quite early when I got to watch his videos when I was starting out really early. And I think it really just, his style really made me lean into the, not like
hectic
whining.
Nature.
This, not the hectic part. It's almost like the humanity behind it.
Right.
Like after he does something wild, it's the screaming of like him going, just accept me. This is who I am. Just accept me, please. And that's the pocket that like I love about Johnny Vegas. Because he's wild, but he just wants people to like him.
You were talking about, to do with this same conversation, you were talking earlier about, you know, looking at people before you and learning from them and moving on. The thought that came to my head was standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, if I've seen further, it's because I'm standing on the shoulder of giants. Mm-hmm. Who are those people from you, from your past? Johnny Vegas, obviously one of them. Who are those giants that you consider yourself standing on the shoulders of today?
Also, Joe Coy, who is probably the most successful Filipino comedian.
Yep.
I'm a big fan of him. And just a lot of like the alternative comedy scene in Australia. And also the buskers that I used to watch at the Christchurch Buskers Festival. A lot of those guys really shaped who I am and how I look at comedy. And I realized that I was, this is what I was talking about before with like comics taking in information without realizing they're learning something.
Yeah.
I realized if I looked at all of my jokes that I'd made, that all been inspired by these comics, and I can see exactly what I did that I got inspired with them, but I never wrote it down or like physically tried to emulate what they did. But I look at all of my work and I'm like, yeah, no, I'm definitely an inspiration of these comics. And so what I'm trying to do now is I'm trying to put those inspirations to the side and readjust my inspirations, hoping that it'll make my comedy a bit more different or like highlight a different part of it. And so I put those inspirations to the side. And now I really love George Carlin, Rodney Dangerfield, early Ellen is a really incredible joke writer, and I'm just like following a lot of like the joke writers in the American scene now and seeing how that will change my style.
Looking around today, I mean, like, there'll be people and like young, although you're only 30, right? But there'll be people who are coming up under you who are looking to you, especially with, I mean, like, let's be honest, with the accolades, there'll be people looking to you who are starting out and coming up and coming under you who are, you know, consider you one of their giants already. Who are the people that you're looking, the next generation that you think, oh, you know, they're doing it. I'm liking them.
There's so many. I love the new stand-up scene, and I love the voices coming through. And I also love that they're my motivation, because the one thing I've I can name so many comics, Pat, but the main thing that I'm really enjoying is that the new generation, you can feel the benefits of YouTube and having video resources from around the world. You can see the impact that that's having with the newer generation coming through, because they're nerding out about it. In first 1-2 years, they know all of the comedy resource podcasts. They know all of the interviews of their favorite comics to watch. They know all of the niche comics that like were big in America and like no one really else knows about them. They're, like, I ask them who their favorite comics are, and I'm like, you are just telling me deep cuts. How do you know these people? This is crazy. And they're nerdier about it than I was when I started. And so that's part of the reason why I want to look at this as an art form, is like, I'm going to get overtaken if I don't keep working, because there's a new level that's about to come through. And if I don't go with them or like learn them or like just appreciate it, I'm going to get left behind. And it's crazy.
Is that a healthy sort of a competition within the scene? Because I've heard some comics internationally talking about, you know, the scene in the 80s and 90s in America was very cutthroat, and no one actually wanted, people would actively take a bad opener with them on tour so they could look even better. Or is what you're talking about, is there some sort of green-eyed, you know, toxicity to that competition? Or is it all love and you're like, nah, oh, you're amazing, but you're going to have to fight to get my spot, baby. Is it that kind of vibe?
Yeah, it's love, and it's a loving way of going, come at me, like, come on, let's see what you've got. One thing I'm kind of like trying to do at the moment is not really like mentoring, but I'm just meeting up with young comics and just trying to give them the tools that I'm trying to figure out now. 10 years in, I'm already going, hey, let's meet up for a coffee. I'll tell you where I'm at. Because I know that if they can get that information 2 years in, they're going to be nuts by like 5-6 years. And then by the time they get to 10 years, they'll be way further than where I started. And that's what I got when I first started. I think I also came up quite fast was because I wasn't afraid to look for mentors. And they gave me so much advice and how to kind of like, and help me skip a lot of crap. And so that's what I'm trying to give to the younger comics coming through. Give them all of my information, take it. I don't think they'll steal what I do. I don't care if they get better than me, because I understand that they're going to interpret it differently to me. And I'm excited to see what they grow into once they start really working some of the stuff that I'm trying to tell them.
It sounds like you're saying the old rising tide lifts all boats. If they get better, it makes a better scene. It helps me get better. We all win.
Yeah, and this is also this like darkness in me where I'm like, yeah, I want the new generation to get really good so that everyone at my level and all my mates get scared. Like, I just want to freak everyone out. I want everyone to just keep working harder.
your parents came to New Zealand in the 80s. Is that right? In the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
There are some stereotypes of Filipino parents being, you know, pretty direct and wanting their kids to do certain things. How was it growing up in the household wanting to be funny? Like, was there funny stuff from your parents within the house? Was there entertaining stuff? Was there music in the house? And when you went down this path of comedy, how did the family react to that?
I think I'm the only creative in the family, like, especially like in performing. And I didn't know comedy was even a job. I didn't even think performing was going to be a job. I just knew that I was really not good at school. I just couldn't keep focus at school. But I enjoyed all of the dumb subjects like drama and music, media studies, all that stuff. And so my parents didn't really know how to accommodate that or kind of like put effort in. I didn't do like speech or drama or any of that kind of stuff because they didn't know about after school events. My article event was, hey, stay at the library till 5 because that's when I finish work and I'll see you there at the library.
Right.
And so when I finished high school, I think I really wanted to get into performing arts. And I told my parents this, and then we had like this big dramatic argument with my mom, and she's crying and screaming, going, you better make this work. And I'm crying. I'm gonna make it work. And so I think it was really tough for my parents to accept it. And I think them seeing me like kind of work and like notice I wasn't making much money at the beginning, that really freaked them out. But then so finally now it's paid off and they're super just relaxed and happy and retired. And they're just, they say that they're really happy that they can just relax and not have to worry about me.
One of the ways you get around that is you give your mother the awards you win. You know, it's like if they don't know what quite is going on, you go, here, mum, you can put the Billy T on your mantelpiece. This is the highest stand-up comedy award in New Zealand. It'll help you be comfortable knowing that, you know, I'm not just in the pub every night drinking. There's other things going on. I'm sure they're not now because you have a much bigger catalog there. But you know what I mean. You can show them through the accolades of how you're doing it. It makes me think as well as you were growing up. If you didn't know you could do it as a job, et cetera, when did you actually know you were funny? Like, do you remember figuring out you could make people laugh?
Yeah, I've always been like an attention seeker. So like that was the names that I kind of got a lot. That's the ones that stuck with me anyway. It's like just, you know, your friends being like, stop being an attention seeker, stop doing that. And, you know, I'd go to parties and I'd always just have to be the center of attention or do something wild so that people will pay attention to me. And then I noticed that once I started doing stand up, I stopped being as wild and like at parties because I finally had my outlet.
Right.
So I think it was more just like I just had something to get something out, and stand up was the best way to kind of get that out of me. And I still love it. I still, doing a good gig will just sort me out and sort out myself, and I'll just ride that high. I love that high. I love the high of the validation from being funny. I think that's what like I've always kind of had.
People talk about dopamine hit, you know, getting a dopamine hit, and the first time they remember getting the dopamine hit and then going, oh, it's a drug and it's a good one. You also had a career or a burgeoning career in weightlifting, which is crazy. I've seen the video of you watching the video of breaking your ankle or popping your ankle, and I haven't watched it because I can't. Like, when I was watching you in that video, I was watching you telling the story of the screen beside you. I'm not going to watch that because my stomach won't let me do that.
Boom! There you go, mate. See you later. And it still stood out of it. Yep, that's in 30 seconds. See you later. Goodbye whole career.
How did you get into weightlifting? And like, because you basically were a hair's breadth away from the Commonwealth Games, yeah?
I was like close. Like, I think like those nationals was like the tipping point of like, okay, the games will be really serious, like a really serious option. And I was training really hard at that point as well. I started weightlifting as a joke, as a drama kid. Because I was the kid that did card tricks to everyone. Right. And then they did a weightlifting demonstration. And I was like, it would be funny if the card tricks kid went to the weightlifting session with all the other rugby boys. And then I went there. And because I had no training, I was still quite flexible. And so what they saw, they were like, oh, he can hit the bottom of a squat and he's got quite strong legs. But then all the other guys were quite tight from all the training because they were really quite strong and muscular. And so they tapped me on the shoulder and was like, you could be good at this. Do you want to give it a shot? And then after a bit of like dilly-dallying for like 6 months, I finally committed to it. And I think that was the same thing with validation. It was the first time people were telling me that I was good at something. And so I had a reason to keep going back. And then I just kept going and going and going. And then I was surrounded by such a good group of weightlifters. My coach was a bronze Commonwealth, won a bronze at the Commonwealth Games. Our coach, his coach was in Germany and coached most of the weightlifters that you kind of saw come up like in the 90s and 2000s. And so I had a really deep well of knowledge about weightlifting technique. And I think I was really lucky to learn the technique really quickly. And I think that's why I could push through.
Is that your MO? I mean, it sounds like, because you've just described weightlifting and learning the skill and art of weightlifting like you describe comedy. Coming out quickly, learning the skill of it, finding the background, getting the research. Is that just your MO? When you find something, you're like, I'm going deep into this and I'm finding out everything I can about it.
Yeah. And if it keeps being fun and I keep returning to it, that's when I really can learn it. Cause I get obsessive. I get really obsessive over stuff. I remember when I was a teenager, I would just watch weightlifting videos over and over again, and my coach would tell me what to look for. And so I just watch YouTube videos and try to look for what he says. He's like, look at this German weightlifter. Look how he stomps his feet and how he catches the bar really tight. And I look at it, I just keep watching it until I can go bang, bang, bang. And I do. And I think it's that analysis that I've taken into stand up where I can watch a comic, because I know what I do as a comic, I'm able to relate it to other comics and I break it down the same way as a weightlifter.
So with comedy, is there a danger of overanalyzing? Like if you're trying to break down your stand-up routine, your comedy routine, is there a concern of paralysis by analysis? Like there has to be an element of free-flowingness or looseness to most comedy on stage, it would appear. Is that ever a concern or a drama? Or have you got it dialed in so much that you can analyze, you can fix, you can move on?
You fail a lot in stand-up. You fail a lot. And I think once you realize that failure is the best way to get better, no gig has any kind of weight to it specifically to be like,
right,
this is the gig that I have to kill and I didn't kill it, so now I have to quit comedy. That's not how that works. It's all good. You learn from your failures. So overanalyzing, if I overanalyze something and I go too deep and it makes me bomb a couple of times, that's all good because I have enough awareness to go, that's all good. I have to take a step back. And then you just recalibrate and take it a step back. And then after about a month, I've fixed those problems. I mean, a lot of people are really worried about overanalyzing comedy, getting too technical with it, and then having it rob your character or your voice because you're so focused on the technique. But I'm not an idiot. Like I listen to my sets. I know when I sound like a robot. What I do is I listen to my sets. If I sound like a robot, then I go the next gig. I'm like, forget the technique and just feel it out and you will find the little nuances and the little textures in your joke. And then I listen to it again. It sounds natural and I go, sweet, I'll hold that and I'll overanalyze a different part. I'm always working, editing, refining, messing it up, refining it again.
So you know when you have done a good set? Like, I mean, it seems when you're performing, you either know in yourself you've done a good set, you know because of the response from the audience, or you know because someone, a manager or something, tells you. You find that you trust your internal feelings? You know when you've nailed it?
Yeah. Yeah. I record all my sets. And so not only do I know if I do a good set, I can go back and I just listen. I listen to the parts that I nailed that I feel like, okay, caught that rhythm perfectly. Or the other one is, oh, I explored that and I found a new laugh there. I'll just listen to that over and over again. One, because it feels amazing that I managed to find something or do something right. But also I'm just learning the rhythm of whatever it is. And I'm just trying to break down, how did I get there? What happened there? And that's all. And that's why I have a standard for my comedy. And that's why I know how well I did, because I have listened to myself heaps and I've done heaps of gigs.
Do you think this is a your generation thing? I've talked to some comedians who may be 15, 20 years older than you, and they're like, oh, no, I don't like listening to myself. Do you think this is because you've grown up, like you were saying, when I was a teenager and I was watching YouTube, I'm like, YouTube wasn't around when I was a teenager. Like, do you think that your generation is part of the reason you're comfortable listening to yourself? Or is it more of a David thing? Like some of your 30-year-old colleagues... It's a generational thing?
It's a generation, and it's because we grew up with smartphones and we grew up with a voice memo app that we can just click, and it was so painless. While I also understand that, like, comics before that, you couldn't build that culture because you're not going to bring a freaking dictaphone to the gig and look like an idiot. But now we all have phones, we can do it. And also I do that because we have video resources. of listening to the top comics. I've listened to James Acaster on an interview say, yeah, I record every set. And then I've also heard stories of comics going, yeah, James Acaster will just go into the green room, go through a set and learn his stuff. And I'm like, if that's what the top guys are doing,
yeah.
I need to learn how to work like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's the new thing also with the new comics that are coming through. They're figuring that out a lot more earlier. And they're able to see this as an art form, and they're able to learn from the very best, which not many comics had in the past. I heard stories of like New Zealand comics. They would wait for like Chris Rock's DVD to come out, and they'd like smuggle it from America, and there'd be one copy of Chris Rock's stand-up special, and they would take turns passing it to each other. Go, listen to this, work this. And it's like, of course, if that's all you've got, that's all you can learn. But now we're in a generation, we have so many different YouTube channels where I can just break it down. You can pause it and just go over and over and over again. The nerdiest shit I ever did, me and my mates used to transcribe Conan sets, the 5-minute sets. We would transcribe the whole thing, and then we would highlight all the punchlines, and then in a different color, highlight all of the premises, and then highlight all the tags, and just like make it look beautiful and color it in, just so we could kind of understand the structure of the set. And then we'd write our own bits and then go, well, what's the structure here? And then just try to mimic it. Just try to get it to that same level. So it's really just, yeah, testing yourself as much as you can, getting so nerdy with it because I love it.
It's funny how fast technology moves. You're talking about, right? I remember doing that with Beastie Boys lyrics, you know, listening, writing it down to learn the song sort of thing. And now on YouTube, there you can just have a look. The words are all AI generated for you. Don't even have to write them down. You just copy and paste, and you could just do it that way. And it would be a lot quicker doing that for a young person today than it was even when you did it, let alone when I did it. I was thinking about you and probably maybe more of your earlier stuff. Getting naked on stage seems to be something you were known for. And it just made me think, you know, Bert Kreischer is coming to New Zealand to sort of known the world over to be shirtless with his big beer belly for all his things. You know, I mean, how do we get you? Would you open up for Bert? Is that something you'd be doing? You kind of you have a similar spirit amongst between yourselves about that?
Yeah, I'd love it. I'd really love it. I don't get asked to open for comics often. And I think it's because of my style. My style doesn't lead into that like nice hum to celebrate the comic that people are actually there to see. Like, I'm going to try go as hard as I can. So I don't really get those opportunities much. But my friend Paul Douglas got to open for Bert, and he told me that he killed it. And I was so proud of him to be able to open for someone like Bert and just crush it in front of him, which was real sick. But yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I'm not too fast. It'd be amazing. It'd feel amazing, but not fast.
But you're saying that because of your style. Yeah, I get it. So you reach maybe a pinnacle of somewhere that might be almost hard to follow, or maybe not make a seamless transition to the quote unquote headliner. So that's not something you really do. I was also thinking about him, Bert, and his mate Tom, best friends that do. I don't know if you listen to Two Bears, One Cave, but I love that podcast. And I was reminded watching your weightlifting video about Tom's basketball injury video. I don't know if you've seen that, but he blew out his knee and his arm, and it's all on video, and his arm was facing the wrong way. And I can't watch that either. It's just, there are things I can't watch. So I was thinking you have some kindred spirits there. You blew something out on video, and you have taken your clothes off before. So maybe Two Bears, One Cave is your spirit animal.
Yeah. I don't know if
that is the case. Maybe. We can't not talk about Taskmaster, because I'm a huge fan of Taskmaster. Any trepidation for you doing, I mean, like, Taskmaster seems to be such a strong show internationally. Like, the format for it in the UK is so strong that it does succeed everywhere else. You know, sometimes when you remake something in a different country, it's like, yeah, but it's not, you know. But I don't know, probably because of the platform and what it is, it seems to be strong everywhere. What were your experiences with Taskmaster in New Zealand?
Oh, it's the best experience of my life. It was incredible. Okay. It was such an incredible thing to be a part of. And I think, like, you gotta give the credit to the people that made it in New Zealand as well. And I think that kind of, I think the quality of Taskmaster New Zealand really comes from comics who have just been grinding it out for years. And the, like, because we all grind in different ways. And the comics that grinded for Taskmaster were the ones that were making Jono and Ben making Funny Girls. I mean, like, it's specifically like Joseph Moore. He's been working so hard behind the scenes and getting so good at making television. And I think it all just clicked with Taskmaster, and he understands TV on a different level, especially comedy TV. He understands how to get those payoffs, what to do, how to get, it's incredible how he works. I have so much respect for him. And I think that's why Taskmaster New Zealand really worked, was because the crew for Taskmaster, also with the Sam Smith and Paul Williams, they all knew the comics because we were all friends. The New Zealand comedy scene is so small, we were all friends. So they could almost, if they knew the cast list, they knew the tasks to write to really get the best performance out of us. If you look at the tasks from that season, a lot of those tasks lean into our strengths, and it's really good because then you get the best performances out of us. Not in like a, I've just revealed the secret of the show or that it's all fake, but it's just like, I think now they just know how to really lean in and get the best performance out of us.
I was having a look, spin-off read a piece about you, meet David Koreas, the Taskmaster contestant who snapped. That was, I believe, the moment when you were writing a rap song or something along those lines, and there was a snapping moment. I also found one of the most funny situations in Taskmaster was the shoelaces situation, where, for people who haven't seen it, David got to do a very difficult task. And as you're saying, they know who you are. Like, I find you high energetic, right? High energy. And so to sit down and sit still for 2 hours undoing shoelaces would seem to be the worst possible thing to do for you, which then leads to the idea that they knew you, and they probably knew what would be the worst thing we could do to David. And that was it.
Follow these shoelaces.
That one?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay. What is about to happen? Untie these shoelaces. Fastest times win. Your start time starts now. We're going to be here for hours. Ah.
A classic task. One for the ages, beloved by all who did it. Did anyone else do it?
Nope.
No. Thank God. I thought I'd got dementia or something.
Oh, no.
So that's obviously a clerical error on my behalf. I could have sworn everybody did this.
I knew no one was else was going to do it. You don't have the time to do that task for everyone else. It gets so much worse.
And they also knew that I'm the only one that will actually brute force my way through a task and won't try to find a loophole. And so I think that combined with having to sit still, I think they were like, okay, let's see what he does. Let's see if he actually does it. Because I like it. I like that challenge. I'm like, okay, let's see. Let's waste everyone's time. Here, I got 2 hours.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, what don't we see on the screen? Like, what was left on the editing floor? Is there any stories you can tell us from it?
I had this one where it was like, I had to defend myself from Paul, and I took it way too seriously. And I think I took it seriously to the point where I'd barricaded the kitchen door. I had a kitchen knife in one hand, and I had a whole jar, like a giant jar of cayenne pepper. And I felt like Shelley Duvall from The Shining just pushed up against the door with a knife, screaming, because I could feel Paul trying to get in. And I don't know what I was thinking. I was like, you're not going to throw cayenne pepper at his eyes. Like, this is TV, David. Like, do not hurt Paul. And yeah, they didn't end up keeping that moment. But I think that was one of my favorite moments that didn't get caught, because it was just such a hectic moment.
Do you think in stand-up comedy there's any stuff you can't joke about? I mean, we hear about people punching up, punching down. We hear about people not jokes about this, not jokes about that. Do you think anything's off limits? Or for you, okay, do you think anything's off limits for comedy? And then for you personally, do you have any lines you draw in the sand?
I think there are no lines in comedy. You can do whatever you want. You just have to be willing to accept the consequences of what you do on stage.
Right.
And you just have to be able to wear that gracefully or just take those hits. And so if you're comfortable, like, talking about topics that will flare people up and you're all good with getting that response, then just do it. Who cares? You'll find someone that likes what you do. And if you can do that and keep being a comic, like, all good. Bill Hicks would perform in the most Christian cities in in states and just do his material and just put and just antagonize people with his material. And there's a bit of a like a respect to that. Would I ever do that? No. But I respect it. And but like I think I hate talking about inflammatory topics. I hate talking about politics. I hate talking about anything that I see on the news or I see other people already having an opinion on online. I hate talking about that stuff because everyone's already informed. Everyone's right. already got their own opinions, and I'm not that smart, and I also don't care. No, the real thing is I don't care, so I don't do research. And so if I do gags on this stuff, it's always just going to be surface level because there's going to be no depth to it. So I avoid it altogether. And there's nothing fun about being a commentator or being a person who has to share their opinions. That's so boring to me and what I do. But I respect, like when you see it done well, it's like, I love it. I love all comedy and I love seeing how the other people pull it off. But for me, it's not fun.
It sounds like, though, what you're saying is the line you draw in the sand is not about, oh, what should and shouldn't be spoken about. It's more like you want to do it well, and because that stuff doesn't interest you, you know you're not going to do it well, so I'm going to avoid it.
Yeah, and I think the challenge that I see in that is instead of hitting those topics head on and going, can I crack them? Can I crack the darkest joke? Can I get it? What can I get away with? Instead of setting those up as my challenge is, okay, the parameters have changed. I can't talk about these topics. The challenge is, well, what topics can you get away with? What can you make good? And my one is, instead of saying inflammatory stuff or saying stuff that will cause tension, my challenge that I really love is, can I make corny stuff funny? Can I do like stuff that people go, they groan at stuff? Can I get the audience to like me enough to get away with it and get a genuine laugh? And so that's kind of where I play.
Like trying to do a set talking about brown versus red onions.
So every joke that I do, there's always like there's some kind of experiment going on with it. And that onion joke, that experiment was how long can I go with bombing, how much can I lose a crowd with these terrible lines and then build so much tension that I release it in one go. And I release it in one go by showing self, like the punchline is self-awareness. It's like, okay, he sucks. He doesn't know he sucks. But I'm also performing it like a pro. Like I'm holding the pauses. I'm waiting for the laughs. And I can feel the tension because they're like, the rhythm is right. Like we should be laughing, but that wasn't funny. And I'm just like, yeah, let's sit in it. And then I just stay silent and just sit in it and look at them and smile like I'm proud of myself. And then once they have, the more silence I have and the more tighter it feels in the room, the moment I give the line about being self-aware, it gets a huge pop. And so that was me trying to make something corny funny. I was trying to make bombing funny.
It's also really brave, though. I mean, a lot of people couldn't sit in the silence. Like to sit in silence as a performer is a really bold move. And some people can't do it. So it does, again, I mean, I'm not trying to label you, but it does remind me of that Andy Kaufman kind of situation that actually... that uncomfortable, creating an uncomfortability in the audience is actually a pretty amazing technique of stand-up as well.
Yeah, I think I got, because I knew that I had to learn to be comfortable with silences, because on YouTube I'd watch all of these pro comics say, you got to be comfortable with the silences. That's when you get good. And so knowing that, I was like, create a bit that puts me in that hole. And by doing the onions bit over and over again for 2 years, I started to really figure I could now listen to the silences, and I now can listen to the levels of the laughs, and that was just my jumping point in. And so now I can take, now I don't do the onions bit anymore, but now I'm able to sit in the silences and work it because I've gotten everything I need out of that skill. Give me a new joke, let me learn a new thing.
It's funny because I see things often in editing. And it's like in editing, you remove the silences and you put things closer together. But you've got your timeline, your editing timeline. You've taken the silence out, and that's the bit you've saved, and you've deleted all the content around it for the next bit. Whereas I think when I'm editing stuff together, I take the silence out and I bring the stuff together. You do the opposite in real time on stage, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, because it's tension. It's all tension. And I think a lot of, like, especially when you see, like, TV comedy, they take away the magic of the moment because they're cutting away the silences and you're not seeing the tension. And the tension is context. You're removing context for that laugh. And so when someone watches that and there's no middle part between that and the punchline or that tension, the audience who's watching it at home goes, that wasn't that funny. It's terrible. But if you kept that tension and you made the people feel awkward, they're like, that's funny now. It's really funny. And you get that in Japanese comedy. Japanese comedy they show everything. They show the ugly tension as well. And that's why you can just see some of their jokes. They really let it sit and it gets awkward. But the pops are so hard and so different because you don't see it much in Western media, I guess.
It's been an absolute pleasure having you this morning, bro. I feel like we could talk for another hour. I'd love to have you back to talk some more as well. But we've got a timetable today we have to stick to, unfortunately. So we're going to have to wrap it up. But if people want to know more about what you're at, where you're at, what you're doing, how do they find you?
At David Post Office on Instagram and at David Post Office on Twitter and YouTube. It's all the same thing. And Twitch. I don't know. I'll get back on Twitch at one point.
David Crass, thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your time in Dunedin. And look, it's been an absolute blast talking to you, mate.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Pat. I've had such a fun time.